All right, so welcome to everybody. We are very glad today to welcome Dr. Richard Van Groff. He's currently a Fulbright visiting researcher at Carleton University. He's from Kansas State University in Georgia. And he has written on very different topics. He specializes in comparative politics, North America, but also Africa, in comparative electoral systems, development administration, and management. As part of his work in Africa, he's a recipient of the Ordre National du Lion from Senegal, and is currently working in Ottawa for his Fulbright. So we are very glad that Dr. Van Groff is going to present the following topic: implementing immigration policy, provinces and states in comparative perspective. And it will be, I think, fascinating. We know that the Canada-US relationship is pretty old and extremely related to the issues that you are going to present us. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Van Groff.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome. Glad you all took time out of your, I know, busy schedules to come here. I'm very pleased to be here on your beautiful campus and in this beautiful province, which I've never visited before. It's one of the few I haven't. The only one left now is Newfoundland. But I'm pleased to be here. When the plane was coming in the other day, I looked out at the vast country. It was quite impressive, quite impressive. I've seen a horizon that broad. Long time. Maybe it's the broadest horizon there is. I don't know. But in any case, I'm very pleased to be here and be on your beautiful campus. And just something I ought to say at the beginning is I'm used to wandering around so when I talk. So if I start to move, they told me I have to be on camera. So if you see me being edgy, it's not because of anything you've done. It's just what's in me in that sense. Okay, so let me give you an outline of the presentation I'm gonna talk about today. I'll start with a look at critical assumptions, I'm starting to wander already. Critical assumptions involving immigration policy, particularly at the subnational level, but at the national level as well. Then move to a kind of a comparative look, and I know this, for some of you know these topics better than I do, so bear with me. I just want to lay the groundwork for where we'll be coming to. Comparative look at Canada and the U.S., both at the national and subnational level. Unfortunately, the subnational level is not looked at very often in terms of comparative immigration policy, but I think it's probably, my bias is that it's probably the most important. The two cases I started with and have expanded to look at some other provinces now, including Ontario and some others. Hopefully this is catch one perhaps as well. Started with two cases, Georgia and Quebec, and I'll explain why those two is more in common and more different between them, I think, as they represent different poles of the immigration role of subnational units. We'll then talk a little bit about the MIPEX approach from the European Union for comparing immigration policies. They have 148 different measures. I won't go through all of them with you today, or even some of them. Part of the goal of this larger project was to develop an index or a set of measures that can be used for comparing subnational units around the world. Okay, and so far, we've got about 18 that we're using, and I'll be glad to talk about those later, but I'm not going to bore you with the details of those as we go along. Immigration success or integration success, this is part of my bias here, looking at all the different ways to measure that. I'm going to look at naturalization, okay, the rates of naturalization and so on, and we'll talk about why that as opposed to some other measures of integration, which I think are not necessarily as comparable or as useful, even they think otherwise, and I hope to hear from you when that comes about. I'll talk a little bit about immigration reform, or potential reform in the U.S., and immigration reform in Canada as well. We'll come to some conclusions, hopefully, or some preliminary conclusions, and then I look forward to your questions, comments, critiques, etc. So that's the layout of where we'll be going today, hopefully going. Immigration policy, you know, why is it so important? Well, it's, you know, as they say, as I've said here, demographics are destiny. That is, North America, we're without immigration, we're in potentially dire straits economically, politically, socially, certainly in terms of those who are going to be required to support old guys like me when I retire and so on, and maybe a few of you in the audience, not many, I think, but you know, we're getting down to the point where we need that sort of population growth. People are not having children at the rates they once did, and we rely very heavily on immigrants. In the U.S., if it weren't for the Hispanic population, we wouldn't have any or almost no serious growth in the population. You may remember a few years back, Lucien Bouchard made his famous comment that Quebec women were not productive enough, and it was not a popular comment, but in any case, he was trying to address the demographic issues and crises facing Quebec. Also, we've got to look at this in terms of the values, the culture, the economies, and so on. I mean, the values of a society have become very, very important, and some people find these to be heavily challenged. Clearly, our friends in Europe are finding, you know, with the foundation of some extreme right-wing parties founded on the basis of stopping immigration, and some governments have risen and fallen on the basis of some of that. So, not only that, I think we need to underline that we have to look at immigration from a comparative perspective. It doesn't make sense to me to look at immigration strictly in Canada or strictly in the U.S. or in France or some other country, because you lose a lot, you lose perspective. Okay? So to get that better understanding, I think we need to genuinely look at this from a comparative perspective, from a comparative subnational perspective as well. So, we always in the States, and Americans always love to talk about American exceptionalism. Well, immigration policy is one of those areas, or immigration attitudes is one of those areas where we get to talk about Canadian exceptionalism. Blumrad and some of her work was one of the first to post that and make it, you know, very current in the literature. Canadians are more favorably disposed, don't ask me why exactly, or maybe we'll figure that out as we go along, more favorably disposed to immigrants than citizens of any other country in the world. No other country in the world that has the same positive attitudes toward immigration, although, see in a minute, they're not way out there. But, you know, if we look at Europe, there's no country in Europe where you find a plurality of people who are favorable toward immigration or toward immigrants, for that matter, even though they have lots of those. Same thing to a large extent in the States. The U.S. falls somewhere in between Canada and other advanced industrial countries in this respect. But Canada's still out there pretty much by itself in that regard. So I think it's very important. Because when you look at some of the data, it may not, if you look at just the data for Canada, it may not give you that same perspective as when we look at Canada in that kind of comparative perspective. All right, so let me go back to some of the key assumptions. I'm assuming that the goal of immigration policy is integration. Whether you're looking for economic issues, whether you're looking at cultural issues, or social issues, or a variety of demographic issues, integration is key, is central to all of those. Without integration, there's other, you know, people who come for jobs, great, they may not stay. Retention rates may be low, there's a whole range, they may not fit into the cultural milieu, etc. So integration is extremely important. Again, the sub thesis here basically is that most of that integration takes place at the subnational level. People don't become integrated into society here in Saskatchewan because of Ottawa. I mean, the kind of things that integrate somebody into a community are not the things that occur in Washington or Ottawa or Paris. They're the things that occur at the local level where people interact with real people. So we have to keep that in mind when we're talking about these policies also. And really the success or failure of integration is something that occurs largely, not entirely, but obviously there are links with the national level, but things that occur below the national level. We need to look at them in terms of states and provinces. Now the MIPEX people suggest that success of immigration policy really depends on the nature and the quality of those legal and political services and things that are put together. Problem with, I think the MIPEX index, and we'll talk about that a little more, is a good one, but some of the real problems with it is it doesn't ever measure the dependent variable. They never get down and say, okay, this is what we're trying to look at. They say, these are the things related to what we're trying to look at, without necessarily measuring the impact, okay, the actual integration that may or may not occur. All right, let me jump over to the two cases I started with, and I should give a disclosure in the beginning. Quebec is an important case, but I should say that some of this research was financed by a grant from the Quebec government, so take that for whatever it's worth. But, why these two cases? A lot of people said, why would you study Georgia compared with Quebec? Well, I happen to live in Georgia for a long time. I'm not living here right now. But aside from that, there's some real important differences in these cases that make them worth studying to look at differences in immigration policies at the local level. As you can see, populations aren't that different. Georgia's a little bigger. They both, like many immigrant societies, most of the immigrants concentrate in the largest metropolitan area. Atlanta is one of the top 10 destinations for immigrants, for legal immigrants in the U.S., as are, you know, and Quebec is, and Montreal is among the top ones also. In both of these, we have over 80% of all new immigrants, that is, documented immigrants, settling in those two cities. So we have that kind of concentration, big trade between them. Both of them have foreign-born populations about the same, 11, 10%. In fact, Quebec is actually low for Canada in that. I think Ontario is way up in the 20s. I'm not sure what all the other provinces are, but Quebec is relatively low in that. Annual documented immigration, you know, about 50,000 a year in Quebec, 28,000 some odd in Georgia. The big difference in Georgia is about 45,000 undocumented immigrants come to Georgia every year. And if we look at the population, foreign-born population, there are about 450,000, or these are the estimates, 450,000 undocumented immigrants in Georgia. So we have these two very different cases. On the one side, we have Quebec, which is a real outlier in terms of subnational units, in terms of involvement in immigration. They get to designate who can come. You don't get your Quebec certificate of acceptance, you don't get to come. If you don't meet their criteria, the language criteria, et cetera, we'll look at some of those in a moment. So Quebec is directly involved. There's only one place in the world where you have more local involvement in immigration, and that's a strange one. That's Switzerland. In Switzerland, to be a permanent resident, it's your canton that decides on that, not the central government. And if you want to become a citizen, you want to become a naturalized citizen of Switzerland, it takes 12 years. You have to be there at least 12 years. And then it's not the canton even, it's your municipality. And people vote on whether you can become a citizen or not. It's a real interesting literature on that, particularly since they found that people with Muslim names are not being voted favorably on by their local communities. But it's aside from Switzerland, maybe somebody knows of a province or subnational unit that does more. I think they do more or have greater involvement than anybody else. Georgia, on the other hand, like virtually all the states, has no role in immigration. Nothing to do with selection. Nothing to do with integration. They don't even provide language training. The only area in which they do that, and states are involved, in a sense, is with refugees, which is a small percentage of the immigrants to U.S. relatively. And immigrants, there's a federal law that provides support for integration services for immigrants. For others, totally laissez-faire. You're an immigrant in the U.S., a legally documented immigrant, you're on your own. There are none of the kind of services you find in all the provinces, like you find here in Saskatchewan or Ontario or Quebec and others. So these two are very different ends of the spectrum in a way, and I think make it useful for comparison. Lest we lose ourselves just in the policy part of that, I just want to underline, we could do this with many, many cases, I just want to underline the importance of this from a humanitarian standpoint. I have a son, a Senegalese son, who was about to get his citizenship, and 9/11 took place. And so it took 14 years for my son to get citizenship. Always worried about what might happen in between there. But anyway, especially since he's Muslim, so never know how people get stopped, and we've had that sort of thing happen. But I just want to give you a case of a student who's, you know, became sort of a cause célèbre at my own university in Atlanta. Her name was Jessica Collado. She was a political science major, senior, her last semester. Brought to the United States by her parents, undocumented, from Mexico when she was 11. Grew up in Georgia, went to public schools, went to high school, applied to and got into the university, was an honor student. In fact, as dean, I signed her, you know, her honor certificates and so on. And so she's in her last semester, she's, as many of our students do, driving around in one of the parking decks, parking garages, looking for space before class. So she stops where she usually stops on the third level of one of the parking decks, and there's, she knows usually there's somebody, people who pull out at that time. So she's sitting there in her car. Campus policeman comes over and says, you know, you're kind of blocking traffic, move on. So of course she moves on, drives down to the bottom of the parking garage, drives right back up, stops in the same spot on the third level. Not the smartest thing to do. In any case, this cop comes over to her now and says, you know, what are you doing? I told you to leave this place. I'm going to give you a ticket. So let me see your license. She has no license because undocumented immigrants cannot get licenses in most states in the U.S. So what does she tell him? She says, oh, I left it at home. And he says, okay, that's all right. Just bring it in next time you come to campus. Come by the campus police station. Show us your license. Fine. Well, she can't come back and show it to them, and now she has committed a felony. She has lied to a police officer in the state of Georgia. So they find out she's undocumented under something called 287G that's run by ICE in the U.S. There's an agreement with various counties. She's arrested. She's put into the system. She's sent to one of these horrible private prisons in Alabama and being prepared to be deported to a country where she speaks Spanish, but she didn't grow up there. She doesn't know anybody there. There's a lot of, I wrote a letter as dean. The president wrote a letter. No response. Because she was a member of a sorority, and you can see her sorority organizing a demonstration there, they managed to contact one of the very conservative federal senators from the state of Georgia, and he agreed to intervene on her behalf as long as no one identified him. She didn't want to be associated with being soft on immigration. And so the last minute ICE intervened, let her out of jail, said she could have one more year to finish her degree, she only needed a few months, and leave her alone. Okay? So her education's been disrupted. Most horrible part of this case I haven't told you yet. Her younger brother, when she's thrown in prison, fears the same is going to happen to you. With suicide. 16-year-old kid. In any case, I just think it's important that we not forget the human side of this, because it's really important. And there's hundreds and hundreds of cases, not exactly like this, but like this, that occur in the U.S., and I'm sure occur in other places as well. All right, so let's get back to the other part of this, and the linked part, clearly. U.S. and Canada, very similar roots in terms of their immigration policy. Both heavily racist, restrictionist, emphasized immigration from Northern Europe, country quotas. In the U.S., they kept changing the quotas as to stop, you know, they moved it back several times. First, they moved it back to the 20s or so, and then they decided, no, it went back to 1892, which was a time, you know, when there were fewer immigrants from anywhere else, and then they based immigration on that quota, on how many people from that country were in the U.S. at the time. Clearly, Canada had all sorts of restrictions. Southern Europeans, Jews, Asians, as we've seen, become a major political issue in BC right now. The kind of efforts by the heir to use that to for election benefits, or maybe the alleged effort by her to use that for election benefits. Find that, so we've had this similar kind of policies. We find the removal, really, of both, in both cases, in the 60s, the U.S. in 1965, the removal of race-based quotas, and in Canada, coming in 1967, with the initiation of the point system. First in the world, first country in the world to use a point system for immigration. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's the case. I haven't found any others. But okay, so just to summarize, and I know this is kind of repetitive, but I think it's necessary to get out there, depending on, you know, some people in the audience may have more familiarity with some of these things. But Canada's goals for immigration. I want to emphasize here integration. You can see that integration turns up in all of these as an important part of this. Surely, economic growth. It doesn't matter what government you've got. Economic growth is critical and key part of immigration policy. Integration to retain those workers and others. Quebec goals, common values, language, integration in Quebec society and culture. In fact, Quebec sends out, as Canada does, but Quebec sends out to every potential immigrant, here's the Quebec values. I've got a copy here if anyone wants to see it. Here are the values that Quebecers hold dear, and most of them we would all agree with, the human rights, equality, and so on. But everybody's expected to sign that before they finish their immigration process. So you have that as integration. Ontario, again, strengthen the economies. They want to increase their success rate in terms of integration. Provincial nominees, they want to increase the economic immigrants. Saskatchewan, correct me if I'm wrong because I'm on ledge here, I suppose, at the moment. You know, sustain growth, attract and retain skilled human resources. Integration appears in the documentation quite frequently. So, key variable we're looking at here in terms of integration seems to show up in terms of the policy statements of those we're looking at. Just to give you further, I won't spend much time on this, Quebec priorities, again, ensuring integration. Economic qualifications, about two-thirds of three-quarters of all the immigrants based on economic qualifications. French becomes quite important. Those who've had experience in Quebec, quite important. Ability to contribute to and become part of Quebecois society. Very, very important. So you have, and the current government, the PQ government, has been trying, but as a minority government, they've had some difficulty and not been able to do it, to create a Quebec citizenship. So you would not just have Canadian citizenship, you would have Quebec citizenship. So again, integration as critical. The U.S., since 9/11, I could say it a few times, security, security, security. Integration, family reunification, some degree of economic diversity. Now again, keep in mind, U.S. immigration is not oriented toward economic immigration. Much to the chagrin of some of our industrial leaders, and Bill Gates is constantly complaining about this, that we don't emphasize or we don't provide enough visas for the most talented engineers and scientists in the world. Georgia, it's become highly politicized. With the rise of the Republican and the extreme right-wing South, you know, immigration's become an issue for the Tea Party and so on. Very, very virulent kind of attacks on those. When I wrote a letter on behalf of this young woman, Jessica Collodle, I was denounced in some of the local press as a communist and all sorts of other things. And one letter said I ought to be sent to Cuba, to which I replied, yeah, you provide the ticket, I'll take it. But anyway, I find that sort of approach or that kind of perspective, they want to control undocumented immigration, but on the other hand, they want to have the undocumented laborers there to serve the agricultural community, the carpet industry, the largest carpet industry in the world, the Vidalia onions and the poultry sort of industries and all that sort of stuff. They used to get all their workers in Georgia from Appalachia. You know, they'd get these poor whites to move down from Appalachia and work on all these things. Well, their kids don't work there anymore. So you have these all lily white little towns, but so there were posters, billboards put up in Mexico, various states in Mexico. Come to Georgia. Climate's good, pay's good, you know, it's housing is cheap, and we'd love to have you here. And they knew who they were recruiting. They also recruited in LA and other places where cost of living was much higher. Come to Georgia, you can send more money home. Schools are good, this and that and the other. The carpet industry even invested strictly with undocumented workers, although people used to be able to buy documents really easily. So people would get fake documents and the companies would then certify that they were legally there and could legally work there. But it's much more difficult, almost impossible, to get those now with all the new ways they have of measuring it. But, you know, the Mohawk Carpets set up a program where they sent teachers from the local schools in Dalton, Georgia, to a university in Mexico City in the summer, all free, fully sponsored by the carpenter, to help them understand how to deal with Hispanic students. So soccer leagues, all kinds of stuff they were doing to try and keep their workforce. So, you know, you'd find these things politically, what's said is very different from what's implemented some places in the states. South Carolina is another one where there were strong restrictions placed. I met a political scientist from the is of Mexican origin, who's at University of South Carolina, and she was included in a meeting at the governor's office after they passed this very restrictive immigration law. And there were lots of concerns. And she said when she attended the meeting, she was shocked because they said, well, wait a second, you haven't really read the small print and so on in the bill. Basically, it doesn't apply to agricultural workers. It doesn't apply to domestic workers. Doesn't apply to fishermen on ships that have less than, I don't know how many sailors on the ship. Who's left? Basically, they were saying, you know, we passed this for political reasons, but it would inconvenience us greatly to not have our domestic workers and agricultural workers and so on. It's a very strange sort of the U.S. immigration agencies used to be under the Justice Department since 2003, now under the Homeland Security, and everything is emphasizing that. The ICE has $18 billion, spent $18 billion. That's a lot of money on 287G, this law that allowed, or this arrangement that allowed local police departments to arrest people who they suspected of being in the country illegally. Basically, people said this is driving while brown. You'd be then stopped and, you know, checked, have your immigration documents checked and so on. So, but 16,000 people were deported from Georgia under that control. These aren't criminals. These are people who were driving without official Georgia licenses and so on. And CIS provides for the legal immigration process. They don't do squat. Go on their website. You find what they do. They give you the 100 questions that appear on the naturalization test, of which you get 10. Okay. Other than the website, they don't provide English training. They don't provide hardly anything at all. And another thing to distinguish, there is no state in the U.S. that has a ministry or even a service or a direction of immigration. Virtually every province has one, be it a corporation or be it a something else. So it's quite different. It's all laissez-faire sort of stuff, in a sense. And just to clarify, immigration categories in the U.S. are just so different from what you're used to here in Canada and what many other countries are striving for. That is economic immigration. Immigration in the U.S. emphasizes family-sponsored individuals. So you want to bring your sainted grandma? Okay, I know you've got a separate process for doing that now here in Canada. This is where these visas go, to direct relatives or to new spouses and so on. The employment-based, those who can contribute directly to the economy, is only 12 to 14% of the visas. The U.S. gives over a million people the right to come and work in the U.S. every year, and only 14% of them fit into that economic category. There's an effort to change that. We have also another strange category called the diversity lottery. A lottery put into effect for political reasons that was basically designed to allow more Irish to immigrate in a particular period in time. But basically, those countries that have sent, in the last 5 years, not sent very many people to the U.S. as immigrants, people who in those countries can go online, put their documents in, apply, and if you win the lottery, and there are millions of people who enter this lottery, you win the lottery, you get a green card and you're allowed to bring your family. A friend was telling me about somebody from Croatia who won the lottery. He was a single guy and he got all sorts of proposals of marriage. But in any case, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And then we have the refugees, about 70,000. So overwhelmingly, it's family support, laissez-faire, no government involvement in supporting, training, etc. If you want to learn English in the U.S. As an immigrant, you go and you sign up at one of the universities or one of the private programs that offers this, you pay your money and you take your course. There's no free English provided except for refugees. There they get to. That's a small percentage. All right, so just to summarize this, basically we have these different approaches to immigration and integration. The U.S., highly centralized, virtually no role for the states, or below the state level, laissez-faire in terms of all these kind of services. Integration is a private affair. You want to come to America? Well, you've come to the greatest country in the world, so you've got to pay to stay here and figure out how you're going to do that. That's kind of the mentality in a sense. And even with the new immigration reform they're talking about, they talk about a higher level of English for immigrants. I guarantee you when and if the bill comes out, there'll be no money in there for English training. None. They'll encourage people, but there won't be any money. All right, as opposed to Canada and the provinces where you have this shared responsibility, relatively decentralized, more so than many countries in the world, and deep involvement at the provincial level in integration. So, you know, we're still trying to get to this thing about integration and at the end, people becoming naturalized as our end goal here, in a sense. But we have very different approaches to do it. Very different approaches. And we'll see how the results differ in just a few minutes. So just to underline this, the constitutional responsibility for immigration in the U.S. is clearly laid out in the Constitution, and the courts have interpreted it as a central function. States do not have a role in that unless the federal government decides to give them one, which they did a little bit in terms of the enforcement of laws against the undocumented. Here in Canada, of course, you have Section 95 that makes this a shared responsibility. Has some other interpretations of this in a sense. In Quebec, the Guérin-Lajoie doctrine still being pushed by some, particularly by the PQ government. And as you all know, that basically that doctrine says any function that's a function of the province that's involved in any sort of treaties, then the province has to approve and be involved. And furthermore, not many people push the doctrine quite this far. Furthermore, if the province has something that's its responsibility and wants to get involved in an international treaty, in terms of paradiplomacy in a sense, or what some would say is proto-diplomacy, they have the right to do it. Canada doesn't have a right to say anything about it. Well, obviously, the Canadian government, Ottawa, has not ever accepted that and is unlikely to ever accept it. But you have to understand the underlying thinking that goes into some of the talk about Quebec independence. Just a quick timeline of Quebec's involvement. Quebec establishes the Department of Immigration in 1968 and gradually negotiates more and more power till we get to 1991, which is the Quebec-Canada Accord that's in play today with a few modifications, but that basically transfers responsibility for most immigration in Quebec to Quebec. Okay, more responsibility than any other subnational unit in the world that I could find. So again, you can follow the changes that went along. Obviously, some of the other provinces were pushing for more involvement and more responsibility, but not terribly successfully, although they got a little bit in terms of the provincial nominees and so on. But going to the other side of this, the key immigration laws in Georgia are all negative. They're all designed to, you know, to deal with the undocumented, stopping people from getting scholarships, not allowing them to get driver's licenses, even prohibiting sanctuary cities. There are some cities like in the south of Georgia where they grow the Vidalia onions, who used to not look at immigration documents, or when someone was arrested, they would just free them. The policy is called a wink and a nod. But basically, that's not allowed. The immigration reform now that they put into effect is the same law, basically, that the same restrictive law that Arizona passed. Most of it's been, fortunately, overturned by the courts, but there's still some key elements. They can still, when somebody is stopped for something else, you have a taillight out on your car and you get stopped for that, they can then demand to see your immigration status. So that's still is an effect. All right, let's get back to this other thing about measuring immigration policy. How do we get to seeing how successful these are, where they come? Migration Integration Policy Index from the European Union is now in its third round. It's designed to measure and compare immigration policies of all the European Union states, plus Switzerland, Norway, the U.S., Canada, and I think they've added now Australia and Japan to the mix. So, but the unit of analysis is the sovereign state. Not they totally ignore variation internally, which I think is a major weakness in the index, which we'll talk about a little bit more. You can see here the list of variables they look at. I think it's 148 different measures, maybe more than that, that look at these various things. If the key dependent variable is integration, looking at their number six, their access to nationality, you'd expect to find a really high correlation between access to nationality and what I consider the most important integration variable, naturalization, citizenship. The correlation there is, it's a strong correlation, it's a 0.5 between that and naturalization. That means, at best, it accounts for, and that's without having a multivariate model, at best it accounts for 25% of the variance. So what are they missing here? My contention is they're missing the subnational units, which are critical in providing integration services. And many of these services, as you can see, obviously are services that you do at the provincial level, or in some other units can be done at different levels. Just to give you an idea, here's the ranking of their countries on all of these measures. You can see Canada finishes third. The U.S. is not so bad in the top 10, number nine. What's worth noting here, though, is in this top third, none of the major European recipients of immigrants are included. You have Germany, the U.K., and France as the big three, getting 60 or more percent of all immigrants in Europe, aren't in that top category. All right, moving on, we need to look at some of the environment for immigration. And I think critical there is public opinion. Right? There are all kinds of surveys of attitudes toward immigration, so on. There's some real problems with a lot of the data. You've just done a very good one. I don't know if anyone's in the room who was involved in the study you recently did in here in Saskatchewan of immigration, attitudes toward immigration. But, you know, we have still Canada and Quebec and the provinces, many of the provinces, as outliers in terms of that sort of thing. There's the sense of nation of immigrants, both in the U.S. and Canada. And we have several questions. If we want to look at these, you get so many different versions and so many different kinds of questions. If we key in on just a few that are fairly common across, we'll get a better perspective on this welcoming sort of environment. So the two most often used or comparative kind of questions are, you know, in your view, should immigration in this country increase, stay the same, or decrease? And it's an interesting thing when you tell people have no idea how many immigrants there are in their country, but if you tell them how many there are, then the support for immigration drops about 10 points. So, and you don't know how many of your people in your survey know that ahead of time. But anyway, so there's a lot of noise, so to speak, in that particular measure. Another question that's often used is, that performs a little better in this regard is immigration good or bad for this country? And I think it's all tied in with these four kind of alternative perspectives that people have on immigration, or at least openly have on immigration. The multiculturalism, or in the Quebec case, interculturalism, which we can differentiate, certainly nuanced from multiculturalism. But as one perspective, the tied into that, the reasonable accommodation notion, that's very, very important in Europe, Netherlands, Belgium, and other places, but also obviously, we had the important studies and sort of after Aéroville in Quebec and this little town saying they didn't want immigrants who did all these things that are forbidden and so on. And even though they had no immigrants in that town at the time, resulted in a major commission to look at that and what reasonable accommodation is. There's the old melting pot kind of perspective that everybody should become the same. And then there's, of course, the clash of civilization models, which says, associated with a famous political scientist from Harvard who says, Samuel Huntington, who says, no, we don't want immigrants because it's going to destroy our culture. It's going to destroy our mission. We bring these people in. That's the end of Western civilization as we know it. Well, when you look at real attitudes, whatever people say up front, when you ask them further questions and so on, I looked at a lot of survey data, most people actually prefer the melting pot. Most people, when asked about immigrants, say, well, yeah, they should become just like us. Even though they may say, yeah, I'm from multiculturalism, so let's have a food fair. Otherwise, they want people to accept their values and attitudes, be just like us. Let's take a quick look at some reactions, and you can see the degree to which Canada remains an outlier. Immigration has a negative impact on this country. You know, nearly three quarters of the people in Belgium, these are recent surveys, UK 64, Italy 56, Spain 55, and so on. Where's Canada? You know, if you looked at this without looking at the other countries, you'd say, wow, more than a third of the people in Canada think immigration has a negative impact on the country. That's really low. I mean, when you put it in comparative perspective, then Canada remains an outlier, remains an important outlier in terms of the impact of immigration. Why Sweden is there, I have no idea. Sweden has a significant number of immigrants, but hard to figure that one. But the U.S. is up in the 50s and so on. Another thing we need to keep in mind, when you see these polls all the time on immigration, is it really a salient issue? Is it something that people think about? In the U.S., it's become very controversial, but it's still not a salient issue. I think the same thing to a large extent here in Canada. The issues about the legitimacy of refugees came up and continues to arise. Integration in terms of values. But when you... And this is the mistake that's made often in terms of public policy assessments in public opinion. Give people a list of things and say, tell us how important this issue is to you. And when you do that, immigration becomes pretty important because you're looking, oh, immigration, yeah, that's important. However, when you ask people to identify on their own, What are the key issues facing Canada? What are the key issues or priorities your government ought to place in the U.S. or Canada? Less than 2% of Canadians identify. Less than 2%. If you ask the question the other way, you get a huge percent that say, yeah, immigration is really important. It's not on the top 19 issues that people identify in Canada as important. In the U.S., even with all the loud talk and virulent stuff, still only 2 to 3% listed as a top priority. Even though it had, you know, an impact on the election, it was more, in, not because that was a top issue, it was because the Republicans were stupid enough to make it, to say some really negative things out there. Talk about people, let's make it so miserable for people that they'll self-deport. That's going to get you a lot of votes. In any case, Romney said the other day he was very sorry he didn't get to become president. Well, I'm not. Sorry for the political statement on the side here, but let's just look at some comparative attitudes, and these are very recent data from 2012, 2013 on a couple of these critical questions. And I think one very important thing is there's been a decline in the percentage of Canadians saying immigration has a positive effect, a real decline. And if you look at some of these, compare the U.S., which is the second column over, with Canada, which is the third column over, immigration to the country should be maintained at present levels. Okay, Canadians a little bit ahead there. Immigration to the country should be increased. The U.S. is a little ahead. Immigration to the country should be decreased. Canada's a little bit. There's no difference. That was shocking to me to see that. Canadians and U.S. citizens are saying basically something very close to each other in terms of the importance of immigration. Canada's generally looked upon as that outlier out there. Now, there may be some other problems with some of these data, but look down at the box circled in red. I don't know if you can see the box circled in red. Immigration has a positive effect on the country. Immigration has a negative effect on the country. I think this is actually a better measure than the first one. It's more consistent. There's less noise in the data when we look at that measure. But in the U.S., 26% says it has a positive impact on the country, and more than half say it has a negative impact on the country. What's surprising, and again, why you need to look at these in comparative perspective, Canada is equally divided, 39-39. 39% think it's a good thing, 39% think it's a bad thing. Again, I found that rather shocking in terms of the overall interpretation of things. And if you look at some other things that are quite interesting here is if you look at the next column over, which is Quebec, Quebec is much more positive in terms of its vision of the importance of immigration, of the impact of immigration. And going over to the far right, I don't have that last one for recent ones for Georgia, so I haven't included it there. But if you go to the extreme right there, province with the largest number of immigrants and the largest percentage of foreign-born citizens, Ontario, 35%. So we have a plurality there saying immigration has a negative effect on the country. Again, I'm not sure, but we need to look at these kind of trends and look at these kind of changes. Let's see, what is happening in Canada? What's happening at the provincial level? If some provinces are looking this one way, some another. Which brings us to the data from this province, which is goes quite the contrary, at least based on that survey done by your own university, your social science research laboratory, just this last year. New immigrants make a valuable contribution to the province. 87% agree. Maybe Saskatchewan's become the new outlier among provinces. In terms of a positive view, may have something to do with the state of the economy and the growth of the economy and need for labor and all that. When people were told the annual level of immigration, which they were in that survey, I couldn't find that they'd asked that without that, you had 54% saying it's about right, although too high, 28.3% is pretty far up there. Now, if that telling them how many immigrants there are had an impact, then we could say that figure would probably be lower in more comparative terms. So Saskatchewan seems to have a very, very positive perspective on immigrants, much more so than many people outside Saskatchewan would think. So it's good that these data were collected. A few other things that are really very, very important in terms of integration, access to public education. some argue that the real success of the U.S. with its laissez-faire perspective on integration is public education, because legally, states, municipalities, localities, towns are required by law to provide public education for kids regardless of documentation status up through high school. Okay, and some say that's been the great integrator. University, much more restricted. Now a lot of states are charging out-of-state tuition, which in the U.S. is really prohibitive. You know, at the University of Georgia, an in-state student will pay about $12,000, an out-of-state student $28,000. So an undocumented student in the state of Georgia now can't afford to go to the University of the state of Georgia. There are a few exceptions. Texas, surprisingly, provides free public education. Now, if we look at Quebec provides, as do most provinces, provides free public education, although it must be in French. Immigrants' kids all must study in French. And they try to extend that even to the cégeps. I'm not sure if they've succeeded in doing that. Now, there was some controversy, and since it's a minority government, it's been a little hard to do that. But basically trying to restrict access at that level. I think that has some impact on their success in integration. But still, the importance in North America, public education is provided for virtually all kids, no matter where you are. And it's very different than some of the situations in Europe and elsewhere. Political environment, very, very welcoming. Quebec, the PQ, CAQ, the PLQ. You look in their documents, you look in their speeches, everybody wants immigration. There's some nuances as to how much and how Francisized they ought to be before they can come and those sorts of things. But basically, very, very positive. Same thing in the parties in Ontario. I believe the same thing applies here in Saskatchewan. I don't think there are parties here in Saskatchewan criticizing immigration, saying it's not a good thing. In Georgia and the U.S., you have this very different perspective where the Democratic Party has been much more favorable to immigration, the Republican Party much less so since the last election. The Republicans are becoming a little bit more friendly to immigration. Because not because they're in love with immigrants and not because they want more immigrants, but because they see that Hispanic is the largest growing demographic and they need them. I'm pretty cynical about that. I don't know if real reform will actually pass. Okay, some other measures of immigration, social capital, that kind of building of that kind of trust, and we can go through a whole range of measures, studies that cover all these. I won't go into deep, I'd be glad to look at more details as we get on. Education, we've mentioned. Income and employment, residents, and I have some more data on income, which we'll get to in just a minute. Over here. But the level and rate of citizenship, I think, is still the most important, language proficiency. It takes 2 to 3 generations in the U.S. for people to become fully integrated. And citizenship rates are quite different. And I think one of the things we've got to look at it from a public policy perspective, particularly as states, provinces, and federal governments become more pressed for funds, is all the integration services. Do they really produce anything? I know there's some people here who work for some of those integration services, and I think they're very positive. But do they really produce anything? If you let people free on their own in Saskatchewan, would they learn all these things they need to do? Would they be successful and you'd save all this money? Maybe all you need to do is provide some language training. All the other services, I don't know. I'm not criticizing them. I'm just saying I think it's something that hasn't been assessed very well at the federal level or at the provincial level. What's the cost per immigrant? Centralized versus decentralized programs. What are the costs involved? I'm not sure there's some inclusive data on those. And I think those are studies that need to be done. It's just assumed. I talked to the proverbial taxi driver on the way in from the airport last night and said, "Well, how do you like it here?" "Oh, I love it here in Saskatchewan." "What do you like about it?" He said, "Lots of opportunity, not as much competition." he was a bright guy from India, I believe. And, he wasn't saying, "Well, the people have been so welcoming, I've got such great integration services and all that stuff." And probably he does. But I think that people tend to, in the U.S., they tend to be integration services provided by people from their same ethnic group, country, province, whatever. Let's just look at, and I think that's something we can talk about a little more in terms of reform. Let's look at what I'm considering the most important measure of integration, which is naturalization. Canada and the U.S. start out in the 70s, U.S. slightly higher. If you look at columns B and, column A and C, I'm sorry, and column, the last column there shows you the differences. U.S. ahead a little bit in terms of integration rates, or citizenship rates. Get down to, you know, a constant decline, and in the 90s, Canada's way ahead. That minus 27.4% is the percentage that Canada leads the U.S. by in terms of the integration or the naturalization of legal immigrants. Great difference. 2006, 46% for the U.S. and 78% for Canada. Now, some people say it's, and there have been a very interesting study, which is by Pepe and you, that shows that that a lot of that can be accounted for by the nature of the immigrants coming. So if you deduct the Hispanics, particularly Mexico and Central America from the U.S., it comes a little closer, but just a little closer. The ones in parentheses you can see, Canada's still way ahead in that. People who come to the U.S., people who come to Canada, mostly stay. Mostly stay when they come and get permanent residence documents. But residents in Canada tend to become citizens much more quickly than their counterparts in the U.S. Part of it is you may talk about the years difference, 3 years in Canada, 5 years in the U.S. But there's more to it than that. You could lag that and see what the impact of that is. 6 to 10 year naturalization rate, as you can see there in Canada, 71%. So people who've been here 6 to 10 years, 71% of them are already have become citizens. In the U.S., 24%. The 20-year naturalization rate, however, you can see Canada 89%, the U.S. 74%. So a lot of old people decide to become citizens in the U.S. After they've been there a long time. There, you know, in 2008, there were 1 million who were naturalized in the U.S. who became citizens. There were 8 million people eligible. You can see here, most of them, I'll go through this quickly again, but most of them shows the same sort of thing. The immigration rate, the naturalization rate is much lower in the U.S. than in Canada. What's the impact? Is this the impact that we're seeing of integration services in Canada? Maybe so. That's what helps bring people to citizenship, if you think that's really important. What is it that brings people to citizenship early? And it may be this difference, very important difference in integration services. Look at this interesting study, just immigrant retention rates. And this is a little bit outdated, but you can see the percentage who come and the percentage who go. And you can see on these data from 2006, Saskatchewan, other than the Maritime provinces, was the lowest in terms of retention of immigrants. I think that's changed dramatically. A couple other things people talk about, the employment rates, and you can see here very quickly, not much difference in the U.S. between people who've become citizens and people who haven't but have the documentation, legal residence. Of course, this doesn't take into account the time they've been there. When you take into account the time people have been there, you can see something quite dramatic, which sort of goes against the integration thesis a little bit. Here we have Ontario, and you can see unemployment rates among the top blue line is very recent immigrants, less than 5 years. Then you go to the 5 to 10 year category down here. And then you go to long-term immigrants. Long-term immigrants, no difference. But there's this multi-year process and sort of see the same thing over here in terms of unemployment rate. Unemployment rates tend to be very high among the first generations. First 5 years, much lower afterwards. Maybe it takes that long for the integration services in terms of employment and so on to really have their effect. Expenditures on integration services, $1.5 billion, and I think that's a conservative estimate of what Canada spends on it. And I'm not sure that includes the transfers to Quebec, and there were transfers to Manitoba and British Columbia that have now stopped also. All right, so we have these differences. We have these great differences in terms of approaches. We have significant differences in terms of naturalization or of citizenship rates. And so, again, immigration becomes remains a very, very important part of this whole thing. Here, the decentralization and centralization approaches, the laissez-faire approach as opposed to the governmental approach. But clearly, the Canadian approach seems to be somewhat more successful in that regard. However, we see attitudinal change occurring in Canada, which is not in the positive direction. It's not that it's bad, it's not that it's really low, but it's still a positive outlier, but it's much lower than it was. So we have to ask ourselves, will Canadian exceptionalism continue? I won't go through the data, but from these case studies and some others, we've derived a set of 18 different variables. I'll be glad to discuss those later that we can use to compare provinces, states, etc. What about the future? Immigration reform, what will it look like in the US? I'm glad to discuss some of that. Will there be a decreasing state role, even though they don't have much role? Will there be some type of point system, reorientation to economic priorities, DREAM Act, path to citizenship, greater support for integration, border security, all these kinds of issues come up. All right, you hear every day now about the new bill that's going to be coming in terms of the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Act in the U.S. I wouldn't bet the farm on it, but I'd bet some money on it. It ain't going to happen. Fortunately, it's probably not going to happen. My best guess is that we're going to have something in terms of the Dreamers, those who were brought when they were children, that served in the U.S. military or have gone to college, who have now become eligible. We'll probably have an increase in the number of economic visas given. Some of the things that aren't well understood, the last time we had a sort of an amnesty back in the 80s under Reagan, most of the people who got their documents did not become U.S. citizens. Very few became U.S. citizens. There was no advantage. Most wanted, in that case, wanted to continue their Mexican citizenship until 98. Mexico did not recognize dual citizenship. You can't own land in Mexico if you're not a citizen, at least within 100 miles of the border and not how many miles of the coast. So it became a real issue. So I don't even know if we had comprehensive immigration reform, if citizenship would go up, as they say. All right, let's look quickly at a few things on Canada. It seems, from all the policies I've seen and from what the current government is doing, you're having greater centralization. Manitoba and British Columbia have lost their sort of control over or the contractual arrangements they had for integration services. There's more seeming effort by the federal government to decide on where immigrants will go on the distribution. I believe there's going to be some study of how effective or cost-effective integration services are. I think that's part of why the federal government has taken some of those services back. You have to ask ourselves the question, too, is it really essential that people move from permanent residence to citizenship quickly? What's the advantage for Canada? Think of some, and I probably can think of some reason why it might not be worth the effort. There may be a greater privatization of integration services. I think we hear more and more about that also. So we're seeing this greater level of centralization, I believe. Quebec is the exception. At the recent meeting of all, as with all these meetings of provincial immigration ministers and other service directors, etc., Quebec wasn't even. The expression of interest approach being pushed as the new approach, Quebec was not at the table. And if you look at the final document, you look at a little footnote says, Quebec is not covered by this. Quebec, I don't know exact wording, Quebec's relationship will continue based on the 1991 accords between Canada. So I think we see some potential major changes and some potential need for some potential new policy analysis. Canadian exceptionalism may not continue to be as exceptional as it has been, although I think it's still out there. The changes in the U.S. probably won't be anywhere near as dramatic as have been talked about. There will be more competition between the U.S. and Canada for highly skilled immigrants, because I'm fairly clear that that's going to be something that the U.S. is going to do. My son works for Amazon, and they've had to place some of their engineers in Vancouver because they couldn't get visas for them. So they're sort of commuters, and I think that's fairly in any case, I'll stop here. So thanks for your attention. I'd be glad to take your questions, comments, and critiques. Thank you.